And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hey, welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody. I'm Phil Lernis, and down under, this is Dean Haglund. Hi, Dean.
I'm Dean Haglund, down under. Finally down under, as opposed to mid under. No, I was above the equator last week, or 2 weeks ago.
You were? What? In Cambodia?
Yes.
All right.
In Cambodia, which is above the equator. Now I'm below the equator.
And how is your below the equator intestinal distress treating you these days?
Fantastic. It's on the mend. The SIBO, the SIBO is perfect, and all is good. So
fantastic.
Let's not talk any more of it.
No, let's not. Let's not. And let's continue to pretend that that the show isn't pre-recorded. Okay, we've got a lot to catch up on.
Yes, we do.
And that's why I don't mind letting people know it's pre-recorded, because God knows we're going to have more celebrity deaths before this show even drops, right? But we have a lot of celebrity deaths from October to catch up on.
Is it because there's more celebrities?
Celebrity deaths.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you over Garrett Watley announcing...
celebrity deaths.
There we go. Is it because of what, Dean?
We have more celebrities than ever before. Is it the age of a plethora of celebrities that
deaths.
Seems that when they die, there's more celebrity deaths?
You mean like there's more people living now than have ever died? That one of those type of things? Well, and yet maybe there's more celebrities that died last month than ever lived. I don't know. But I do know that Tom Petty died, I think, literally the moments after we finished recording the last time.
Exactly.
And he is an American rock star. I think we can all agree on that. And I was actually surprised to realize how much of his music I knew, believe it or not, because I never would have described myself really as a Tom Petty fan. And yet, boy, so many instantly recognizable tunes. He was 66 years old. He was...
Yeah. Surprisingly young.
Yeah, one of the top-selling musicians of all time. More than 80 million records sold in his career as a solo artist with the Heartbreakers and with his supergroup, the Traveling Wilburys.
Right.
His success spanned from 1977's American Girl to 1989's Free Fallen to 1995's You Wreck Me and beyond. The list of his popular and beloved songs is not a short list. Like I said, I was surprised at how many of these tunes I knew from his almost 30 albums.
I know. Think of that output. 30 albums. Good Lord. That's so much. And, you know, I knew one of my first girlfriends was a huge Tom Petty fan and had collected all the albums, seen him in concert. Was devoted to this guy. And so my experience of him was through her eyes. And she talked me into that he wasn't just a good old Southern boy, but an accomplished musician. And well done on that. So from then on, I always kept an eye on his music.
His... early beginnings are interesting. I mean, like with all these artists, listening to their early work again is fascinating. And And almost always surprising, even though this is often the way, right, to learn that he didn't catch on in his homeland nearly as quickly as he caught on elsewhere. He was a much bigger hit in the UK, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, in like 1976, 1977. And really, to a degree, it wasn't until the advent of MTV where he becomes really iconic here with some of the most indelible videos of their time, including 1985's Don't Come Around Here No More, which was a surrealistic Alice in Wonderland themed video, and 1994's Mary Jane's Last Dance, which was a very creepy love story which starred Kim Basinger as a corpse beloved by Tom Petty's character. And both these videos, like I said, very famous, very popular. They both won MTV Video Music Awards and were frequently played staples of the station's programming for a long, long time. And they're still cited among the, you know, the lists of best music videos of all time. He would play and record with the Heartbreakers throughout his career, releasing an album with them as recently as 2014, an album called Hypnotic Eye. But he did, of course, record, as we mentioned, solo outings and with the supergroup, the Traveling Wilburys. And
right.
I was a big fan of that first 1998 album, Traveling Wilburys Volume 1. It featured, in addition to Petty, of course, George Harrison, Roy Orbison, Bob Dylan, and Jeff Lynne. And they did a follow-up album in 1990, humorously called Traveling Wilburys Volume 3. There was no Volume 2. And, of course, Volume 3 was minus Orbison, who had died shortly after the first album was released, actually.
Right.
And some of his biggest hits are solo songs. Full Moon Fever, Free Fallin', I Won't Back Down, and Runnin' Down a Dream. In addition to all that, he was pretty cool on screen and enjoyed a little bit of an acting career. He played the mayor of Bridge City in Kevin Costner's rather notorious film, The Postman. But he also appeared in It's Gary Shandling Show and as himself in a hilarious turn in The Larry Sanders Show. And he provided voices in such animated shows as The Simpsons and King of the Hill.
Look at that. That guy. He's always making it. Wasn't he teaching Homer how to write music, if I recall that episode? It had everybody in it, right? Like Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. It was the all-rock episode where Homer's is going to go into songwriting, if I'm not mistaken.
So born in Gainesville, Florida, he dies just a little bit before his 67th birthday. And, yeah, I mean, 67 for a rock and roller, I guess, isn't a bad age. But it still just seemed, it still seemed shocking because he had been so relevant so recently, you know?
Right.
Another giant of music that we lost, Fats Domino. Early rock and roll superstar who sang such enduring classics as Blueberry Hill died at age 89.
Wow.
Now, Blueberry Hill was his biggest hit. It went to number one on the Billboard's Rhythm and Blues chart for 11 weeks in 1956. But the New Orleans native recorded several other very well-known songs, both before and after Blueberry Hill sealed his fame. And he influenced very much the development of rock and roll, both with his suggestive lyrics and, of course, with his rollicking piano playing.
Right.
In 1950s, The Fat Man was one of his earliest tracks, and it was the first rock and roll song, Dean, to sell 1 million copies.
Wow.
That's pretty cool, huh? Ain't That
really
a
cool.
Shame is a song that we play every morning when people are walking into the Breakfast Club. It's one of the tunes that that we play in kind of our introductory program, you know, before our piano player Don Snyder takes the stage. We always have a little program playing up on screen. And Ain't
right.
That a Shame is one that we selected from the 50s. And it is a song that Fats Domino performed in the 1956 movie Shake, Rattle, and Rock, And that's all the right. clip that we show on screen. It enjoyed moderate success, even though it's quite the famous version of it now, thank God. But its moderate chart success, as was so often the case for these black R&B performers, black rock and roll performers in the early days of rock and roll, the chart success was eclipsed by a white artist's watered-down cover version, in this case, Pat Boone. I'm Walkin' was another R&B chart topper that was eclipsed on the pop, Billboard pop charts in 57, when Ricky Nelson covered it that same year. Now, in credit to Ricky Nelson, he always, from what I understand, made sure that the original recording would be the flip side to his recording, so that at least the artist would get some more residuals for the master, and also would be exposed potentially to new audiences. So that was pretty cool.
Right.
Born Antoine Domino Jr. in 1928, the son of French Creole parents. He grew up, Fats Domino did, around music, watching his father play violin, learning piano from his brother-in-law. He spoke Creole French before he learned English and was performing in New Orleans by the time he was 10. He was discovered by bandleader Billy Diamond while still in his teens playing at a backyard barbecue. He joined Billy Diamond's band and got his first taste of musical success. Fats Domino was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in the inaugural group in 1986. What's sad is that despite his legendary status by the late 80s, he was living by choice in a working-class neighborhood of New Orleans, opting to stay in the city that was home rather than touring. What's sad about that is that the entire neighborhood was destroyed by Katrina. And
right.
But the silver lining, if we can say, to that is that because of Fats Domino losing his home, his neighborhood, everything he owned, it gained attention because of his celebrity, and at least that neighborhood was helped by a tribute album to Fats Domino that musical artists such as Paul McCartney put together. So his inclusion...
And then they also mistakenly wrote and spray-painted... R.I.P. Fats, we'll miss you, on his house, thinking he had died in there.
Well, yeah, because he couldn't leave. Yeah, because he couldn't leave. Right. So there was a real fear that he had died. Yeah, he had to be rescued. Yeah, that's a true point. Anyway, really one of the greats. Number 25 on Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 100 greatest artists of all time. He won one of the Presidential National Medal of Arts, which Bill Clinton presented to him in 98. And he's a member of both the Louisiana Music Hall of Fame and the Delta Music Hall of Fame.
Now, look at that guy.
One of my favorite comedic actors of certainly television, though he did some fairly phenomenal film work, and indeed I saw him on stage, Robert Guillaume. The best act, the actor best known for his starring roles on Soap and Benson, where he played the titular character, a character he debuted on Soap, died at the age of 89.
Oh.
And
I didn't know this.
Like I said, his career spanned the Broadway stage. Yeah, you were in Cambodia when this happened. He played on the Broadway stage, was a fixture on Broadway, and of course television and movies, and became a prominent voice actor later in his career, and was accomplished in both drama and comedy, as well as in music theater, and quite impressively managed to steer clear of Hollywood's demeaning black stereotypes at the time he was coming up, and he demanded quality roles in which he could evoke his character's humanity. He was born in 1927 in St. Louis, Missouri, served in the U.S. Army before getting a chance to act professionally. And although he's remembered widely as a comedic actor, it was the musical theater that was his first love and gave him entry into the professional acting world. On Broadway, he actually appeared and won a Tony in 1976 in an all-black revival of Guys and Dolls, where he played Nathan Detroit.
Classic.
And it was that performance that brought him to the attention of television casting directors. And he got an offer to be a regular on a television show. I saw him on stage as the replacement for Michael Crawford in Phantom of...
No way.
And his mask fell off.
No.
Yes. So that's one of my
favorite... Wait, where?
Fell off during a number. It just fell off. Whoops. Spoiler alert.
The thing is...
Yeah.
That's a... Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was rough.
Wow.
So, anyway, back to the TV show he was offered. The show was Soap, and this thing still holds up really well, this show, Soap.
Yeah.
It was a new primetime comedy at the time that would parody daytime soap operas. Guillaume's character Benson was the butler. Now, he was keenly aware of the history of black actors who for years had been relegated to playing only slaves and servants, and it felt like a step backward. As he once admitted in an interview, it thrusts you back in time. It's as though nothing has changed since 1800. But he took the role anyway. He took a chance on it, and it resulted in a chance for him to elevate that very character from butler to state budget director to lieutenant governor. Because the transformation happened after Guillaume received his own spinoff, Benson, which premiered in 79 after two seasons of Soap, and after he had become such a popular and beloved character. One of my favorite episodes ever of Soap is a parody of The Exorcist. And the scenes where he confronts the devil are so spectacularly funny. There's one bit in particular where no one else has the courage to do it. And he says, my mom always told me when you meet the devil, you grab the devil by the horns. And then he does it. He confronts the devil. And then he quickly says, my mama was a damn fool. That's what she was.
That's funny.
So of the transformation of that character on the spinoff, He told the Washington Post, I wanted the character to have the kind of upward mobility that it did have because it mirrors the American dream. He won an Emmy for Soap in 79, and he won a second Emmy for Benson in 1985, a year in which he also portrayed the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King on the big screen in Prince Jack and the abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who Donald Trump hears is doing some great things these days, in the TV miniseries North and South. In 92, he and his wife, Donna Brown, founded the Confetti Entertainment Company, creating read-along books for children with Guillaume narrating them.
That's cool.
This marked the beginning of his voice career that would grow rapidly. He was cast in The Lion King in 1994 as the mandrill shaman Rafiki, and he went on to play that role in sequels and spinoffs, winning a Grammy Award in 95 for his narration of the read-along book of The Lion King. But in 1995, the Confetti Entertainment books that he published were transformed into the HBO television series Happily Ever After, Fairy Tales for Every Child, all of which were narrated by Guillaume and featured a cast of other stars, 39 episodes. So how about that? A desire to get into voiceover leads into an entire cottage industry for him.
Yeah. Boy, that's a smart move.
Finally, in 1998, he was cast on the Aaron Sorkin dramedy Sports Night, which only lasted 2 years, is one of the great underappreciated shows of all time.
Shows, yeah.
And he played the managing editor of the sports news program. It was a role that he loved, and the show was still in his first season when Guillaume experienced some confusing symptoms. He stumbled, he was finding walking awkward, and he eventually fell in his dressing room. He was having a stroke, and it caused temporary paralysis and affected his speech. He had to undergo rehabilitation therapy, but as soon as he was able, he was back on the show. They wrote the stroke into his character, and he was able to work his rehab and recovery into his performance as his character recovered on screen as well. After cancellation, Guillaume continued to take on other projects, including the movies Big Fish and Secrets of Jonathan Sperry. One of my favorite roles of his was from the early 80s, and it's a supporting character turn. He works for the governor, and he's friends with the attorney general played by Charles Grodin in the Neil Simon comedy Seems Like Old Times. And
right.
He is such the brilliant straight man in that film.
Fantastic. I haven't actually seen that. I'm going to go see it now. I'm sure it'll play again somewhere.
So a sad month for great character actors. Another one of which, who I had enjoyed quite recently, Brent Biscoe, died following complications from a serious fall. He was 56. And
good Lord.
This is a guy who always would play cops. He played cops in movies like The Dark Knight Rises, The Majestic, Mulholland Drive, which was directed by David Lynch, who then recently called upon Briscoe to play another detective in a great role. He gets such a good role in the Twin Peaks, The Return, the revival this summer. Lynch said, "I loved him as an actor and as a great person. I'm holding good thoughts. I will really miss working with Brent again." Another director that was a fan of his was Sam Raimi, who cast him in one of his most acclaimed roles in the thriller A Simple Plan, and also put him in Spider-Man 2. He was a frequent collaborator with Billy Bob Thornton, in addition to A Simple Plan, which Billy Bob Thornton wrote and acted in. He had a supporting role in Sling Blade, which actually helped pave the way for Briscoe moving to Hollywood in the first place. And he's been in so many Billy Bob Thornton vehicles.
Right.
So just really one of those character actors that you immediately recognize, who's so good in everything that he does. He just brings the real world with him. There's never too many of those kind of actors. And
right.
And sadly, we are denied any future performances by Brent Biscoe, dead at 56. Now, not as sad, because here's a woman who lived to the ripe old age of 100 and who was able to act in French cinema for 80 years. Danielle Derrieux, the leading actress of French cinema, died this past month. Renowned not only for her acting ability and beauty, but also for, let's face it, just the incredible longevity of acting for 80 years.
Yeah, I know. Hello.
She appeared in 100 movies, well over 100 movies between 1931 and 2010, including Marilyn in 1936, The Earrings of Madame De in 1953, and Eight Women in 2002. Her first film, Le Ball, was 1931. She was 14. It led to a series of successful musical comedies, and her appeal at the box office, as well as her beauty, caught the eye of Hollywood. And she was brought to the United States to star in Universal's 1938 film, The Rage of Paris. She did not enjoy working in Hollywood and opted to return to Europe after completing the film in 1938. During World War II, she continued to star in films despite the Nazi control of the French film business. So as a result, her name appeared on a French resistance death list for alleged collaboration, even though her husband was quite an outspoken opponent of the Nazis. After the war, she was forgiven by members of the French resistance, but her popularity waned for several years, and it really seemed like her career was over. She's a woman in her 30s, and suddenly she's washed up. But she enjoyed a renaissance, appearing in the American musical Rich, Young, and Pretty in 1951, and the spy film Five Fingers in 1952.
Right.
And this reaffirmed her status as an international star, and she cultivated working relationships with so many top directors. She starred in a trio of films by the great Max Ophuls. In addition to Earrings of Madame Deux, which is one of the greatest films of all time, she starred in La Ronde, which is my favorite Ophuls film, and also House of Pleasure. She starred in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg for director Jacques Demy, who also cast her in two of his later musicals, including ones in which every line of dialogue is sung. She received an honorary César Award, the French National Film Award, in 1985 for the longevity of her career. Can you imagine that after winning a Lifetime Achievement Award for the longevity of her career, she would continue to work for 25 more years?
Yeah, normally they give you that one as a way to say thanks. Thanks for playing.
Yeah, after we haven't seen you in a little while.
Yeah.
All right. Now we're going to move into some quicker remembrances here. A couple that I wonder if you know. Ralphie May, a stand-up comic whose career took off after appearing on Last Comic Standing, died in Las Vegas at age 45.
Well, yes. And he was known as the large overweight. I mean, he had some heft on him for sure. But ironically, he followed me on the improv stage the night I got my long hair chopped off by Rick Overton. Ralphie May was the next act on after that, who commented on, what the hell was that? So, a great guy, really funny material, and real tragic loss in the comic world for sure.
He appeared on The Tonight Show, on The Wayne Brady Show, and he had four stand-up specials on Comedy Central. Born in Tennessee, raised in Arkansas, but got his start in the comedy clubs of Houston. And he was recently named the Casino Comedian of the Year.
Which I didn't know they actually had an award for such a thing. But he was really funny. And in L.A., he lived down in West Adams before anybody lived down there, when it was still dangerous in the hood. And a lot of his material came from living down there. Which was really funny if you ever saw him on the stages in L.A.
Walter Bunny Sigler, a singer-songwriter and producer who helped create the indelible The Sound of Philadelphia in the 1970s, died at age 76. I'm going through a lightning round here a little bit.
Lightning round.
Elizabeth Bauer, who starred on the TV series Ironside, has died at the age of 69. She took over the lead female role on the series after the departure of Barbara Anderson in season 5 of the show. Ray Dautrice, a veteran British actor, died at 94, known for his role as Leopold Mozart in the Oscar-winning film Amadeus. And through many, many theater and television roles, including a Tony Award in 2000 for his role in the Broadway revival of A Moon for the Misbegotten. And very well remembered for the CBS television series Beauty and the Beast, and winner of a BAFTA award for Best TV Actor in 1969 for his role in Misleading Cases. He also, not too long ago, gained many new fans as narrator for the audiobook editions of George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series of novels, which, of course, helped inspire the TV fantasy Game of Thrones. Now a Canadian, Dean, John Dunsworth, actor best known as Mr. Leahy on the comedy series Trailer Park Boys, has died at the age of 71. This is a very popular Canadian series, originally airing on Showcase up north, and then picked up and running for additional seasons on Netflix.
Yeah. The guys living in the trailer park, drinking scotch and driving around. I'm surprised.
He
died.
He native of Nova Scotia, and well known for many years for his regional theater appearances there. And he also was on the supernatural drama series Haven, and that show ran on the Sci-Fi Network for 5 or 6 years, I think it was.
Right. Yeah. I watched Haven. I binge-watched Haven. That's how much I loved that show.
Gord Downie, who made himself part of Canada's national identity with songs about hockey and small towns as lead singer and songwriter of the iconic rock band The Tragically Hip, has died at age 53 after a battle with brain cancer. Tell me a story about opening for the Tragically Hip, Dean.
I never opened for the Tragically Hip, though I was in San Diego, where the Tragically Hip, for some reason, never caught on in America, and they were playing at a bar with a $5 cover charge, which blew all the Canadians that were down. I guess it was during Comic-Con. Why else would I be in San Diego? And it was, they're going, wait, Tragically Hip's playing at a bar for $5? And everybody went and saw them do an amazing show. They were an amazing act and many albums. Oh, right. He just died recently, didn't he?
Yeah. Just this last month. Did.
Good Lord.
Legendary jazz drummer and vocalist Grady Tate died at the age of 85. Scott Puteski, co-founder and guitarist for the band Marilyn Manson, who went by the stage name Daisy Berkowitz, died from cancer at the age of 49. Al Hurricane, known as the godfather of New Mexico music for developing a distinct sound, bridging the state's unique Hispanic traditions with country and rock, died at age 81. And George Young, the songwriter guitarist for the Easy Beats and the producer for AC/DC, died at age 70. He was the older brother of Malcolm and Angus Young of AC/DC.
Right.
So a bad month for the music biz. A lot of people lost. And that, my friends, is your celebrity deaths for this week.
Celebrity deaths.
Now, Dean Haglund, you had an assignment that I'm going to bet you have not gotten to yet, but it was asked after on my most recent appearance on the Midweek Drive there on Siren FM and Southside Podcasting in the UK. Your assignment was to watch Star Trek Discovery on Netflix. Have you started doing this?
I have. I'm three episodes deep on four episodes deep on it, and continue to watch it, actually, against my better judgment, dare I say.
Okay, that's not a bad way. From what I've heard, among others from our friend Matty Giles, who was reviewing the shows, he's glad that he took a break after the first few before reviewing the next few. From what it sounds like, the show finds, if not itself, finds where it's going to be going in the next few episodes.
The CBS, if their strategy was to show the first two to hook you into buying into their streaming service to watch the rest of them, it was a massive blunder, because the first two, tonally, directorially, pace, is so different and so not what the rest of the show is, that I would think shocked, actually, to know that that's the same series. It literally, the first two just left us scratching our head, thinking that nobody had actually watched Star Trek who was doing this. But then, to spoiler alert everybody, the science officer goes against captain's commands and then is jailed for treason. And on her ship, while she's off to her penal life sentence, is transported to a new starship that may or may be doing something illegal against Federation rules. And then now you have a new series all of a sudden that's completely separate from the two-parter that started it all. So you're actually thankful that the tone is different, the captain's way better, Doug Jones playing an alien species that we'd never seen before is on the bridge as well as he was in the first two episodes. So it's got some hope, as one would say.
It's interesting. I was, as you know, at a film festival not that long ago that has its roots, its origins in science fiction. There were many science fiction films showing there, many fans of science fiction. It's been more than almost 2 months, I think, since the show premiered in the U.S. certainly longer, you know, more than 6 weeks anyway. And I've heard nothing. I hear nothing about this unless I seek out online sources of information. According to Alex Lefchuk, that's not true in England. We talked about this financially. You alluded to why CBS's methodology might have not been smart because of those first two episodes. I, as you know, I'm not going to watch this because I'm protesting the methodology by which they're bringing this to audiences. I think they don't care about the, you know, the brand, even if the people who making it do. I don't think they do that the powers that be, the financial powers that be, that care about this, because they've taken what was a sizable audience and turned it into a small audience, and they say they don't care because it's in their financial interest to do what they're doing. I wouldn't question that, but it's not in terms of growing and building the brand, which this might story-wise be able to do. And you'll weigh in on this in future weeks, but... So it's fascinating to find out that in other countries people are talking about this, whereas here they are not. It is not, from my experience, gaining much of a cultural foothold here. And how could it when they're relegating it to the smallest niche of the smallest niche?
Well, and they're throwing it under the bus for the sake of the survival of CBS
All Access
filmed entertainment.
Yeah.
Yeah, All Access. All Access, they're seeing as... the only future of a subscription service because of the success of Netflix and Amazon Prime, right? And that avalanche continues to grow. I don't know if you've read that Netflix this year alone dropping $8 billion into original programming. That's eight with a B, billion dollars. And I believe at the height, Fox's budget for all... this was X-Files, everything Fox was doing, I think was running at $950 million.
You know,
for all shows.
Apropos of not that, but of the streaming services, you know, Amazon Studios puts a lot of money into original content, both streaming and for theatrical release, just like Netflix. And, you know, their head of programming got ousted after sexual assault charges were revealed against him. Right. So you can bet, Dean, that the first two domestic distribution companies I'm hitting first for the Lady Killers are Amazon and the Weinstein Company. Guys, you want to rebrand? Here's your opportunity. Come out on the right side of this conversation. Well, I look forward to hearing more from you after you've had a chance. Let's say you weigh in after seeing six episodes.
Okay.
I think that's a really good place, from what I understand, for you to give us another report on it, because you're through three or four right now. So let's say after six. I have been watching, I've watched the first three episodes of season three of Mr. Robot, and I am pleased to say that although season two of Mr. Robot did find its footing eventually, it was very hard work that season, and it had misplaced kind of the magic, for lack of a better word, of that first season of Mr. Robot, where so effortlessly this show seemed to be revealing us something we had never seen before on television. And I'm pleased to say that by episode two of season three and throughout the terrific episode three, they've rediscovered the magic that they've lost, that they had lost, Mr. Robot. And in his second season of directing all the episodes, Sam Esmail, the show's creator, has really come into himself as a director. And I felt him pushing against his limitations in season two. So that's so maybe I'll check in on that after six episodes as well. Now let's talk movies. We got a little bit of time to talk movies. You said you had some that you wanted to discuss.
Well, yeah. So I'm flying Vietnam Air for the first time to Cambodia through Ho Chi Minh City. And that 8 hour plus an hour... 8 hour flight allowed me not only to see things that were on the regular rotation, but some Vietnamese comedy movies that I need to discuss with you. including one called Taxi What's My Name. Right there. That's funny, right? Plotline there is, as you would imagine, an absent-minded reptile professor puts, because he's off to, oh yeah, that's it. He's off to his fiancée's engagement announcing dinner, where he's got the ring, and they're not quite fiancé, yes, they've just been boyfriend-girlfriend, but he has to get to Da Nang, Da Lat, near Da Nang. That was the whole comedy bit there. And he puts his luggage in the wrong cab, and then somebody puts the wrong luggage in this cab, and he gets into that one before he realizes he's in the wrong vehicle. And hilarity ensues, including, a woman who suddenly goes into labor at the thing, and the driver and the absent-minded professor hate each other, and slowly, through all their perils, seem to magically fall in love. Except then at the end, when he finally gets to his fiance, she forgives him and they go off to get married, and the cab driver drives off by herself. And you're like, wait, wasn't this a romantic comedy? That was the most downbeat. What a cultural difference romantic comedies are in other countries, where it's hilarity, hilarity, and oh yes, the cabbie ends off alone. And he goes back to the woman who was, not only did that woman get another proposal from a hunky French doctor who has been her best friend and wants to marry her, she goes back to the absent-minded reptile professor for no other reason than he has another ring. Like, it made no sense culturally.
Oh my goodness.
How these romantic
works. I think this is available in its entirety on YouTube, if I'm not mistaken. Vietnamese movies with commercials are available on YouTube. It's Taxi, okay. What's Your Name? And
totally.
I love
the worst.
That you did this.
I watched the whole thing. Oh, my gosh. And then there's one joke in there that I need an explanation, and I'm sure it has to do with how children are named, but the cab woman says to the absent-minded reptile professor, what's your name? And he says, it's Ha Pa Throng. And she goes, Ha Pa Throng? And he goes, yes, my father died during intercourse.
Oh, my goodness.
Pause.
Oh, my God.
Pause, just kidding. My name is Ha Throng Pa.
Oh, my God. Well, that's
so
a great joke.
If somebody could explain that joke, if everybody could just go to YouTube, look that up. Just go to that bit. It's around, 30 minutes in. And then just have that joke translated.
Right now, he's in the women's room by mistake. I've been fascinated. I got distracted. As soon as you started describing this, I looked this up, and I'm several minutes into the movie right now. So I don't know. We might just need to cut the show now. At the 43-minute mark, because I can't talk about anything else. I need to be watching this.
I can't talk about it. I kept watching it. It's a totally watchable.
So then, when you what else did you watch? You watched that. Where do you go after that?
Well, right. So I needed a romantic comedy that sort of fulfills promise. And what better way than something that Warren Beatty might direct late in the career? Called Rules Don't Apply.
Oh, well, I saw this. Yes, I saw this. I talked about this last year. Beatty gives Beatty gives a pretty nice performance as Howard Hughes.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was a really cool interpretation. Kind of sort of crazy, but whimsical. I mean, we knew he had that weird, I forget what the actual name of the brain disease he had.
Dude, don't you feel like it's kind of a movie that Howard Hughes would have directed? I mean, it's because it is sort of schizophrenic, and for lack of a better word, but it is a movie. Beatty painstakingly tries to make a movie, both in terms of technique, but also in terms of timing, that would have been made in that era. And the young people, first of all, I love the Alden Ehrenreich, who's so great in the Coen brothers' Hail Caesar. Just a standout, breakout performer. Yeah. And, of course, he's going to be playing Han Solo. But then the young Lily Collins, right? Phil Collins' daughter is the young ingenue. So really charming performances. Does the love story work? I don't know if the love story works, but...
No.
But it... And when Beatty's not on screen, the movie suffers. But it's funny. It is really funny.
It is funny. And I found it just heartwarming, actually. It kind of in embracing the gosh darn values of 1964 Hollywood, that there is a level of sexism, but there's also some sense of purity going on. That it's, you would think that 64 was that year of the clash of a social revolution going on, but then still the holdover of the 1950s conservatism in America, that that's sort of the year those two would face up. And that's sort of what I saw in this movie.
I caught up with a couple of comedies from 2017. The first is from your friend, written by your friend and starring your friend Kumail Nanjiani, The Big Sick, directed by Michael Showalter. And I'd wanted to see it. I'd heard wonderful things about it. I like Kumail as a performer. I knew it would be funny. The fact that it's directed by Michael Showalter gives me real pause. I think he's terrible. I think he's a terrible director. I won't even go back to say he's weak. I think he's terrible. Hello, My Name is Doris. The thing with Sally Field may have been on my worst films list last year. I don't know if I did a worst films last year, but it's terrible. And he's especially bad with actors who have more, cachet than he himself. He does not reel them in. And I think what I'm realizing after seeing The Big Sick is he just kind of leaves actors alone altogether. Because Kumail, who is funny, who can't not be funny, and who's trying, God bless him, but it shows how hard it is to play yourself. When people say, oh, well, so-and-so was just playing themselves, that is not an easy thing. That's really hard. No one's work just playing themselves should ever be underestimated. It is harder to play yourself because you're constantly running into the risk of commenting on things, of mythologizing yourself. And this is a story about how Kumail and his wife fell in love, fell apart, and got back together surrounding her coma. The actress, Zoe Kazan, who I'd seen on Broadway, does a wonderful job playing Kumail's wife. And because she's an actress, not playing herself, you know, so it's really tough.
Right.
And you need to have a director, I think, who's really strong, helping keep you out of the traps that you can fall into as a performer. God bless Ray Romano and Holly Hunter, who play Zoe Kazan's parents, and the wonderful Indian actor, especially, who plays Kumail's father. These people are such old pros that they know enough not to ever try to make the movie be about themselves. So they play real characters. They bring real life to it. They're funny. They're touching. But they also know to restrain themselves in a way that I don't think the director, based on his previous work, would know to have them do. So it's a good film. I think it's actually a far better script than it is a movie. But at times, like I said, thanks to some of these supporting performers, it really flies. And that's The Big Sick. And I expect that it might very well get an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay.
Wow. Well, that'd be great.
Yeah, it would.
But good things for Kumail. I think
for him, I would like to see him get to write and act in more things, more vehicles for himself, and also... heck, we need more romantic comedies. You and I are never been the demographic for these movies, but we need them. There needs to be some. And you're the one who's always quick to point out to me, you know, you can't judge it based on the formula, because the formula exists for a reason. And the question is, how well do they apply or work against the formula. So that's one comedy. The other one, and I will call it a comedy more than a comic book movie because it works best as a comedy and it works best as a family comedy, and that is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. It does not have the same easy, immediate charm of the first one because, you know, you only get, like, Ghostbusters 1 versus Ghostbusters 2. The novelty and the freshness is going to wear off.
But for sure.
I do think some of the scenes, sequences, and set pieces in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 are as funny, if not funnier, than anything in the first one. But at the same time, it doesn't really feel like a movie to me because I don't know what the story is that they actually gave a shit about.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's sort of a series of two-person relationship family squabbles. So it would seem. Father, son, daughter, sister, I mean, or daughter, sister, sister.
The adopted family. The
adoptive family.
Yeah, the adopted fathers. And some of those scenes are great. Some of those scenes are fantastic. They're just in search of a story.
Right. They're all sort of tacked on. Like, here's how, here's the thing about family. Oh, let's stick that here. And there's nothing really attaching it to it other than it's the same Guardians of the Galaxy going through it all at the same time-ish.
Yeah, it almost feels like what would have been an episode of the TV series Firefly.
Right.
And you can get away with it as an episode in an ongoing series, but the plot is not enough of an excuse to hang these scenes absent any particular story. And I won't say it was a disappointment because I feel like the word was kind of that the bloom was sort of off that rose. But the point that I want to make is I do think that there's territory to mine in here because clearly at times it's incredibly funny and incredibly entertaining. So as always, have a story to tell before you decide to do the sequel. And that's been a big problem for Marvel. They've done some really nice first movies or some second movies, but they're not cautious about making sure they have a story they want to tell before they go ahead and do it. No, they've already booked in these release dates. Now let's figure out what the movie is going to be.
Right. And, go make it.
And that doesn't always work.
No.
Speaking of sequels, Dean Haglund.
Yes. What sequel are you sequeling?
You know, 2001 A Space Odyssey is my all-time favorite science fiction film, and I will fight you if you say that it isn't my all-time favorite.
I don't think it's your favorite.
My second all-time favorite science fiction film, Blade Runner. 1982's Blade Runner. Although, actually, my second favorite is 2007's Blade Runner, because I've been a fan of every cut of it, but I think each cut of it gets better than the one before. So 2007's The Final is my favorite. So these films have something in common, other than just being atop my list of favorite science fiction films. They both also had sequels made by other directors. 2001 A Space Odyssey had 2010, directed by Peter Hyams. And as we talked about, it's an underappreciated little science fiction movie.
For sure.
A pretty big hit at its time. But it, you know, the shadow, understandably, of 2001 was so large that it was dwarfed by comparison. But it was certainly a superior space adventure. It just was not a massive work of art like 2001. And to a degree, by explaining the mysteries of 2001, if it didn't diminish the original, it did diminish itself in so doing, I think. So I bring this up because Blade Runner 2049 is every bit the work of art of its predecessor. And it takes the mysteries of the first one and asks, why does it matter? Why do you care? It's a beautiful piece. It's a beautiful tone poem. The question is it as good or as fun a movie as the first one? And that's what's so odd a question, because, Dean, in 1982, the movie was rejected because it wasn't fun. It was bleak and it was depressing. What is odd is looking back at that movie 35 years later, and it's fun, and it's actually warm, and it's witty, and it's whimsical. Things that were always in there, but in 1982, in context of the summer of E.T., and Rocky III, and Poltergeist, and Star Trek II, movies like The Thing and Blade Runner were cold and dystopic in a way that we did not want to see. I did.
Right.
I did, because I love those. But people did not want to. But damn, if less than predicting the future, and by the way, we walk around in various parts of this world right now, and we do feel like we're walking around in Blade Runner. But less than depicting the future, I think Ridley Scott was depicting the future of movies. And what he was saying was, you know, replicants are the future of movies. We're going to be watching robots in movies, not actual living, breathing beings. And you know, and damn if his dystopic film that was rejected for being so uncold, so unfeeling by contemporary standards seems more human than human. So, 2049, the complaint I've heard is that it's so cold and it's not so entertaining and it's so bleak. But this is set in 2049. So I think to really judge it, we're going to have to wait till we get there and see how it feels. Because indeed, it might be depicting the future as well. And it has to. It has to double down on the dystopia of 30 years later. Of what that Blade Runner world would look like 30 years on.
Right.
It's doing well, I think. But maybe you and I have talked about this, but I think it's hilarious when people keep asking the question, why is the movie failing? Why is it tanking? Why is it doing this? Because it's made, when we're recording this, it's a week and a half before we're going to release this episode. But at this time, it's made, you know, $220 million worldwide, which is an astonishing amount of money. But it cost $155 million to make, so it needs to make about $400 million. So the question is, you know, why is it failing? Why is it failing? And I don't think it's failing at all. I don't understand why anyone would think a three-hour R-rated dystopic tone poem was ever going to make $400 million. Why do we think that the movie failed as opposed to, once again, the business methodology failed that says this movie has to perform to $400 million as a disposable consumer item right now, not as its predecessor proved, as a movie that is going to be standing the test of time, is going to be playing somewhere in the world, everywhere, for decades to come.
And this is the thing about movies, and it's a commodity that keeps on making money. You know, the fact that I Love Lucy today, and this is announced by Fox at their annual thing, that show still makes the network $25 million a year in advertising revenue. They've long paid off residuals. Everybody who's worked on it is dead. They own it carte blanche, and they make $25 million a year off that product still. And that's the same with Gone with the Wind. All those movies that are big still make millions of dollars, and no one goes, oh, I Love Lucy was a failure. It's just thinking on the marathon as opposed to the sprint.
It's not the movie's fault. It's the business's, it's the methodology's fault. When you and I shared offices together, that credit crunch was happening, and you heard everywhere in Hollywood, that, the movie business is recession-proof. And suddenly it wasn't.
That?
And suddenly it wasn't for the first time ever. But But it wasn't because people lost appetite for entertainment. No, the reason that the movie business was recession-proof was because that appetite grows in times of turmoil. In fact, we saw in regional theaters, live theaters, attendance going up after this recent recession, because things like the humanities go from being a luxury to being a need, because we need to be reminded why life is worth living in the darkest of times. So the need and the demand is still there. It's your methodology of financing them and distributing them and exhibiting them that is not recession-proof, especially when it's built on the same financial house of cards as the system that's crumbling around it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, at the time, I mean, the first recession, the Great Depression, you had a separate... The studios stood in and amongst themselves as its own business method, as its own company. Now, through conglomerization, we're part of GE and Viacom and whatever other microwave-making companies out there. And so we are part of the global economy, not counter to it.
Not all the studios, obviously, but in the 1970s, great recession there as well, and most of the studios did quite well. Because, again, they made many movies, they made them at a range of budgets, they released them gradually, and they adjusted the release campaigns around what worked or what didn't work. And if a film didn't play in a certain area, they'd move it. And if it played well in a certain area, they'd expand it. They could operate in such a way that was organic to the film, to the market, to the time. It was not, as you've always said, an era of corporate franchise product locomotives. And that's where we are. And it derails again and again and again. It's as if Snowpiercer, that movie that I love, is actually just... Maybe I should examine that movie as a metaphor for the film business. Maybe it is an allegory for the film business. Anyway, we're at the end of what I hope was a really exciting, action-packed, meaningful episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. I'd like to float a quick production meeting idea at you, Dean.
I like it.
At the end of each year, we've taken to counting down our top TV shows of the year. And it occurs to me that the last time we did anything like this was, again, almost 10 years ago when we counted down our all-time favorite TV shows. But I think that there's been so much great television since then, and favorite is different than best. I'm going to say that at the end of this year, what if instead of our top 10 shows for 2017, let's count down what we think are the 10 best television shows, scripted television shows.
Scripted shows.
Yeah, not
one would watch.
Not late night,
again.
not news or documentary or anything like that. But yeah, top 10 scripted shows of all time.
Yeah, I'm in.
Let's do it, because it would be really fun, again, to analyze why things stand the test of time, despite, or maybe because of, how we consume these things differently now than we did before.
Well, and yes, has my taste changed? Has my perception, oh my gosh, could that be that those that were my favorite are no longer my favorite?
I mean, if we're saying best and not favorite... There's a very real possibility that Remington Steele will not be on my list. If we're saying best, not favorite. If we're saying favorite, well...
That's a whole nother bag of wax.
Anyway, you can find every episode we've ever done of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. Download them, stream them, subscribe via iTunes. That's...
Even write a review.
chillpackhollywood.com. Can people like us on Facebook, Dean Haglund?
Oh, I insist they do. Please like us. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood and follow us on Twitter and Instagram with the same handle, Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
You can, what else can you do? Oh, write us. Please write us. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. We'd love to hear from you. And we'd love to read your email on the air. That's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. We'll be back again.
Go watch. Yes.
What?
Watch Taxi, What Your Name, and explain those jokes to me.
I'll watch that. You watch Star Trek Discovery, and be prepared to talk about what we're reading. It's been too long since we've talked about that.
Oh, it sure has.
Until next week, I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then. Okay.
Belated spoiler alert.